Hi, everyone. Welcome to Just Mental Health with Steph and Em, the podcast where we discuss mental health issues from a social justice lens. I'm Emily.
And I'm Stephanie. A quick disclaimer before we get started. We are mental health professionals, but this is not to be taken as professional advice.
We are also aware that our privilege may cloud our perspective on some topics, and we not only welcome, but encourage you to message us with criticism and correction. Let's get started. So we have a really cool business of the week. A friend of mine that I've known for since college, so I've known for a little while now. He's an artist. So he makes ketubah. So a ketubah is a Jewish marriage contract. The correct plural in Hebrew is actually ketubot, but he asked me to say ketubas for simplicity's sake, but I just wanted to clarify. So he makes ketubas, Hebrew calligraphy, and Middle Eastern art. And he said he also is, you know, willing to expand out of that and you do like kind of some custom like marriage contract frames and stuff like that. So his art is really cool. He's on Instagram. It's Oodles of Doodles 614 if you want to see some of his art. And if you're interested in getting in touch with him, his email is danepstein614@yahoo.com. That's danepstein614@yahoo.com.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So let's get started on our topic. So today we're going to be talking about the myth of the model minority, racism of Asian Americans. And we have a guest today, writer and content creator Belinda Kai, who has written and spoken with Asians in America, joins us. And Belinda is a close friend of mine as well. And we're really excited to have her here. Welcome, Belinda.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's gonna be so cool to have you on because when we were talking about doing this topic, I was like, you know what, I don't know anything about this topic for real. So it'd be interesting to learn and to learn along with our listeners. So you've written and spoken about this, something you're very passionate about. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to me and other people that don't know what the model minority myth is?
Yes. And I also wanted to say, Stephanie, that it's not uncommon to not have heard about this, because mm-hmm. I think when it comes to conversations about race in America, Asian Americans are often left out. You know, you hear mm-hmm. a lot about, you know, obviously Black Lives Matter and about, you know, other more marginalized groups. But I think Asians tend to be kind of dismissed or kind of lumped in with whites. So I'm really excited to kind of dispel some of those, you know, those myths today yeah. in our conversation.
Definitely. Yeah.
And so to answer your question, the model minority myth is a misconception and stereotype that all Asians are hardworking and successful with excellent educations and careers and should therefore set an example for other minority groups.
Mm. Ah, okay. I've definitely heard and seen things related to this.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel like that is problematic?
So there are several points I want to address, and I'll give a quick overview to start with. Mm-hmm. So first off, it erases the very real struggles and racism that all Asians, including the quote, you know, successful ones, face. Secondly, it's used to leverage shame with other marginalized races, you know, like Blacks and Latinos and Indigenous folks, kind of implying that if Asians can do it, why can't you?
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, it erases the really long and often forgotten history of Asian American oppression in this country dating back to the 1800s. So I'd like to talk about all three points today.
That's awesome. We're ready.
Yeah, those are all. What'd you say?
Oh, I said we're ready for it.
Yeah, we are. No, those are important points. Why don't we just go down the list? So can you read the first one again?
Yeah, so the first one is that the model minority myth minimizes the very real racism that all Asians do face in America.
Gotcha.
So this, you know, starts off with overt racism. So Asians being called ethnic slurs, Asians having their safety jeopardized, Asians being denied service. And I think a lot of this more, you know, aggressive racism has been heightened since Trump took office, because he's really pushed a lot of anti-Chinese sentiments both before and after COVID, but especially after COVID,
right?
You know, with him calling it the Kung Flu and the China virus.
Yeah,
so I'm sure you've heard of, you know, attacks on Chinese or, you know, Asian Americans, including children, because of COVID and the misconception that, you know, oh, you're responsible because you're Asian, which is ridiculous.
Well, you know, I actually have it. I mean, I have from people who are Asian have told me that they've experienced these things since COVID and with the way Trump has handled it and labeled it. But it's not something, I haven't seen news reports about it. I haven't seen anyone in the media talking about it, really. So I don't know if that kind of goes along with the just kind of overlooking what Asian Americans have to go through and the racism that they face in this country.
Because I was about to point out that same thing, like the fact that a lot of people aren't aware of this, it just goes to show that the struggles of Asian Americans is just not, it's not prioritized, like it's not seen as like newsworthy. Which is really sad, and it's very problematic because it's a very real issue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I do think that when it comes to race in America, you know, Black people are the most marginalized, and this shouldn't be, you know, an oppression Olympics. It's not about who's, you know, more or less discriminated against, but I do think the conversation surrounding Black lives is so important that, you know, I can see why it would overshadow some of the experiences of Asians and the discrimination we face. But nonetheless, I think that it should still be common knowledge and it should be out there more, you know?
Yeah.
So I agree with you both on that.
Right. And that, you know, that reminds me of the whole concept that a lot of, I'm sure yours too, Stephanie, a lot of our clients say things like, well, I shouldn't be upset about this because other people have it worse. But just because other people have it worse doesn't mean that your situation still isn't a problem. You know, so, I mean, you know, I really appreciate you acknowledging that Black people are the most oppressed, and the importance of Black Lives Matter. And so then that tends to, I think that society tends to see it as like, oh, well, they have it the worst, so they're the main ones that we need to worry about. But that, you know, that's not true. You know, other people do experience it to different degrees and different ways, but it's just as, you know, it's just as valid, so.
Absolutely. So aside from the overt racism, I would say what I experienced the most and have experienced throughout my life the most is something called microaggressions. Mm-hmm. So it's when people say, you know, little remarks like, oh, wow, your English is so good. Or, you know, the kind of classic, like, where are you from? And I got a lot of that back when I lived in Ohio, where I think there were fewer Asians and people were maybe a little bit, you know, less educated about, you know, different like racial groups. But, you know, it's still something that over time you just start to feel very othered. And, you know, I just started getting angry when people would make those comments. And I don't think it always came from like a bad place, or I don't think they always had bad intentions, but nonetheless, I'd be like, hey, look, my English is good because I've lived here my whole life and I'm American and English is my first language, like get with the program. So I think it is important to, you know, speak up and educate people when they do make those kinds of comments. Yeah. But I think,
go ahead. Well, I was going to relate, not relate, but point, that's like similar to if you were, if like your family immigrated here from China the same way that someone else's family immigrated here from England, you know, like, and, but you don't hear people being like, oh, like, have you had your like afternoon tea or like, you know, like, because it's like, if you're white, it's like, they don't, the people just don't realize that like we're all immigrants and but right. Some we're just like we don't pay attention to, like no one asks white people like where are you really from or and yeah, I remember in high school people would be making a lot of rude, I mean we were in high school, not that that's an excuse, but a lot of really rude comments about Asians and that always used to really bother me. And those, yeah, like those microaggressions are like, it's like the death by a thousand paper cuts, you know, and people think like, oh, this is just one little thing. Like, why are you getting upset about it? But if you deal with a little thing at one after the other over time, it adds up to a lot and it ends up being, you know, causing some racial trauma for you. So.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think that it becomes normalized and then you start to find yourself laughing at these jokes that are, you know, very self-deprecating. And then you even start to make self-deprecating jokes yourself to fit in. And I think that all becomes internalized racism. And of course, at the time, I didn't realize what any of this was. I didn't have the vocabulary for it. I, you know, just kind of thought this is the norm. You know, if you're not white, you get teased and you just deal with it, have a sense of humor. And it's really remarkable how much that's changed in just the last few decades, even the last few years. Because, you know, just thinking back to high school and even before that, you know, when kids are like especially cruel and mean, it's just kind of surprising that some of those things were laughed at and just completely encouraged and not shut down. Whereas now if somebody makes a joke like that, I think everybody in the room would just get really uncomfortable or, you know, somebody would be like, whoa, like that's not cool. Don't say that kind of thing. So I'm glad that there's been progress.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, wanting to always tie in the mental health piece to the conversations that we have on this podcast. So you mentioned it becomes like self-deprecating. Would you say that was like a big piece of the, do you feel like it helped, it affected your mental health, like with the way you saw yourself?
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. I think that before I even received any of these comments, I already viewed myself as different. You know, I already felt othered just simply because of the way I looked, growing up in such a white area. But then when it became so normalized for people to make racist comments, I absolutely took that to heart and kind of felt, you know, inferior or, you know, just had a more negative self-view and my self-esteem lowered. And I didn't, you know, realize this was happening, but like you said, with the 1,000 paper cuts, like over time, I think it really took its toll. And I'm just glad now that I realize what racial trauma is, and I'm trying to work on, you know, kind of healing that trauma. But yeah, I would say anyone who isn't white probably has received, you know, some kind of, you know, has racial trauma. Mm-hmm. And it's no different for Asian Americans.
Right, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, actually, I was going to ask a question and then I just forgot. So maybe it'll come back. That happens, so it's okay.
So I'm still under the category of just general racism. Mm-hmm. And another point I wanted to bring up is that when Asians are othered, we're lumped into one monolith.
Mm.
You know, I actually think that people just kind of assume like anyone who looks like me is Chinese, and I happen to be Chinese, but you know, Asia is such a huge, diverse country with such rich history, and to not acknowledge that and to just kind of lump everybody in as like, oh, they're like a successful, like, you know, Asian is definitely detrimental. And I actually meant to talk about this earlier, so I'm going to loop back really fast. But even the comments that are seemingly, you know, uplifting Asians are really harmful, because when people say, oh, like, he's Asian, of course he's, you know, successful. Or, oh, but you're Asian, why aren't you better at math? I thought Asians were like great at math. It might seem like, oh, like people are saying Asians are so smart, but it's actually really harmful, because it just puts this unrealistic expectation on Asian Americans. And if you're an Asian who isn't great at math, like myself, mm-hmm. you start to feel like there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
So it's almost more insidious, because, you know, it's kind of just like one of those like, oh, haha, my friend is such a good artist because, you know, he's Asian. But it actually kind of strips away that person's individual accomplishments and kind of says, oh, they're only good at art because they're Asian. Oh, of course they're successful, it's because they're Asian.
Yeah. And that, you know, I would guess that creates this like not good enough kind of complex, or like not like I don't fit in with my race, or like I'm not what everyone expects me to be, or like kind of thoughts about yourself like that really affect your self-esteem.
Yeah, totally. I actually talked about this specifically on an Al Jazeera Plus video. And in that video, I talked about my own upbringing and how I just never felt good enough, because there was a lot of competition between me and like other Asian kids I grew up with. So if I didn't have the best grades or like the best test scores, or if, you know, I wasn't, you know, the best pianist and didn't succeed in X, Y, and Z areas, I felt like there was something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. You know, if all of these other Asian kids can do it, why can't I? And I think I already had mental illness before I started feeling this kind of pressure, but I think this pressure to succeed exacerbated my mental illness and my symptoms. So yeah. I definitely think that it's really, really hard on these Asian kids to, you know, feel like you don't fit in and feel like you have to live up to all of these standards set by your parents and by society. And if you can't, yeah, you definitely feel this kind of inferiority complex.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like you have to be exceptional all the time. And so, whereas for white people, we can be as average as we want and nobody says anything about it. And it, I was reading this, I can't even remember who said it. And so I feel bad quoting it now, but, someone was talking about how, like, in America, poverty is seen as something that happens to people who deserve it. But white people see themselves as, you know, they're just in poverty temporarily. And they're not there because they've done something to deserve it. They're there because, you know, all these other minorities are keeping them from their success. And so it's like this double standard of like white people can be very, very average or even below average, but it's not our fault and that's okay. But, you know, don't do the same thing as us if you're a minority, because then that just doesn't look good, you know? And so this, I'm sure that would be a lot of pressure, especially if you're going to school in a place with, you know, mostly other white kids. That would be a lot of, they're going to expect you, because of the stereotypes, to be getting straight A's and doing everything and just like have all the answers and nobody.
Right, exactly. And I think it actually goes beyond just Asians. I think that all minorities who are like at a prestigious university get the same kind of feeling where they have to work twice as hard and be very exceptional just to feel like they have some semblance of fitting in with like the white kids. So I do agree with you, Stephanie. And that brings me to my second point, which is that the model minority myth is used to kind of shame other marginalized races into kind of, you know, the thinking that if Asians can do it, if they can be rich and, you know, socially acceptable, why can't you be? And this falls in line with the whole bootstrap like idea or myth also that anyone can just work hard and succeed. And that shifts blame from systemic racism and oppression from white supremacy and pretty much instead just puts it all on the individual. And if you're someone who is a person of color who has endured, you know, generations of this kind of oppression due to white supremacy, you're suddenly left with feeling like, oh, well, why can't I succeed? Like, these Asians are minorities, they're succeeding. So it's really pitting Asians against other minorities, which I find to be really horrible because there should be solidarity, you know, with all minorities, in my opinion.
Right, right. You're all kind of, you're all being oppressed by the same system, just differently, but it's still, nobody is like winning in that case, but it does sort of portray it as like, well, look, they came over here, they've done all this, they own their own business or whatever, they're very hardworking. You know, if everyone else could just do that, then that would be great. And that's not the way, that's just not the way things are set up. And I wonder if, and I don't know, so I'm asking from a total, you know, just ignorant sort of position, but does that breed some sort of prejudice, you know, from Asians towards other groups?
Oh, absolutely. I know as many racist Asians as I know racist white people, sadly. And I think Asians like to kind of align themselves with whiteness. And that's probably why a lot of Asians I know aren't very outspoken about like Black Lives Matter or any other, you know, political or like social issues, where they tend to keep a little quieter. And that's not to say that all Asians are that way. Just, these are just some of the people that I know that I grew up with. But I think that a lot of Asians do kind of silently side with whiteness and have the same kinds of beliefs that, oh, well, I did it, why can't they? But mm-hmm. what they're not realizing is that, like, Black people in America, you know, brought here against their will, subjected to slavery and torture, you know, denied, you know, housing rights with through redlining, mm-hmm. you know, just so many endless horrific forms of discrimination being pushed into the ghettos because they weren't, you know, able to get homes in white neighborhoods. All of this was something that was shaped by, again, white supremacy and by the US government. And a lot of the Asians that have immigrated here as scholars, as students, like my dad, and came here with the intent of getting an education. And this actually happened when, and I'll go into this later, but there was a whole ban on Chinese from coming into the US for a while back after the railroads, when Chinese people were seen as, you know, minorities stealing jobs from like the working white man.
Right.
And after that ban was lifted, there were Asians to come into the country, but these Asians had to be like scholars and merchants and people who were already pretty well off. So those are the Asians that we think of when we think of the model minorities, you know, the ones who came here to become doctors, the ones who came here with, you know, some money or to get an education, and yes, are leaving their, you know, homes behind and have their own set of traumas and struggles, but haven't been kept down for, you know, decades and decades and centuries. Mm-hmm. So it's just a completely different kind of thing. And you really shouldn't be comparing the two groups. But I do think that, again, with the model minority myth, there is comparison.
That's so interesting. Like how this myth is impacting other groups, like the way that it's, you know, like how you might expect that if we're gonna have a conversation about racism of Asian Americans, like we're only talking about racism of Asian Americans, but racism or, you know, having these myths about Asians creates all these other, there's so many pieces of this that kind of bleed into other social issues that, you know, I just didn't know, I hadn't thought about it, any of that before. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, actually, when George Floyd was murdered, one of the cops was an Asian American cop, and he was completely complicit. And the Asian community didn't really speak out against him or condemn his behavior. So it's instances like that where I just really think that if there's anyone who's listening who is Asian American, we can't be silent and complicit just because it doesn't, quote, affect us as much. We have to stand in solidarity with, you know, these other minorities who we're hurting if we keep silent. Just like white people, if white people keep silent, you know, we're complicit just like them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I remembered what I was going to say earlier, but you kind of brought it back around to that. You know, you guys were talking about how in high school, it was, people were just getting away with saying these racist things, either overtly or these microaggressive stuff, and people weren't really calling them out about it. And now people are a lot more vocal about calling people out when they do that crap. And, mm-hmm. which is great, but I really, that is all, of course, it's all minorities deciding we're not going to be quiet about it anymore. We're going to call people out when they say this stuff about us. And, so being, you know, able to, assert for yourself and advocate for yourself and, you know, speak up when you see these things happening, call people out when they say these things to you is a really huge strength that has just sort of changed the whole culture of just the people holding each other accountable for these things. And of course, you know, unfortunately, the people that have been oppressed by it were the people that had to change the system and start calling people out. But, you know, I just wanted to point that out, that I think that's really, really when that started changing is when people were like, you know, we're not going to just, it's not, you know, like Belinda said, just have a sense of humor about it. Like, no, it's not funny. I don't like it. I don't appreciate it. It's not okay for you to talk to me that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there are Asians who are very privileged and there are Asians who aren't. And that's the third right. talking point that we'll go into. But the Asians who are privileged, the ones who kind of side with whiteness, they're the ones who need to speak up the most, because it's great when, you know, the most oppressed people are the ones at the helm kind of asking to be treated like humans. But the people that are going to listen to, you know, the white people who are going to really listen to this kind of thing, to discussions about race, they want to hear it from other white people or from privileged Asians. So people who have privilege yeah. should be the ones speaking out, because they're the ones who can probably have the biggest impact.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's just another message I want to convey.
And, you know, that was something I had kind of been thinking about that when we started doing these, where we would just have guests on to talk about either a subject that they were really passionate about or something that they had experienced personally, which tend to go hand in hand so far, it has seemed. But it's sort of that, like, you know, anyone who's listening to this, not that we have a huge audience pool, but we do have a decent one. And so people listening to this can hear a conversation from someone, can hear their story and their perspective on something that they have had to deal with, that they've experienced personally. And it's not, you know, unfortunately, that is easier for white people to take in. You know, if you just are like talking about systemic racism, at least when I talk to other white people about systemic racism, there's like, they will glaze over, like they don't care, mm-hmm. you know, they can't, mm-hmm. so they stop caring. But I've noticed when they start to care about an individual and they start to know someone individually, they start to listen. And it's sad that it has to sort of be that way, that they can't just say, you know, this minority group is saying that this is how we are experiencing the world, this is what is happening to us, we don't just believe them. That has to be more of a conversation with one particular person. But it really does help when someone can educate other people in that way by sharing their experiences, doing that sort of labor that they don't have to do. But I think it really goes a long way when you break it down and you show the individual, if that makes sense. I feel like now I'm rambling, but.
No, it makes sense. I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
I think it's important for people to share their experiences. And again, I think I come from a fairly privileged background because my parents did come here, you know, to go to school, and they have had luck in the workplace. And in that regard, I'm privileged. And I would say that my life, you know, of course, I've dealt with a lot of things that I didn't even realize at the time were like traumatic to me. But I would say overall, I feel like I'm pretty lucky. So sometimes I don't want to speak out about it because I'm like, well, do I really want to complain about this like little thing or this like little comment when they're, you know, like, you know, Black people being shot by the police. But I do think you're right that, you know, we all need to share our stories and hopefully have empathetic people or people who aren't even empathetic, you know, read them or hear them and become more empathetic.
Right, right. Yes, thank you. You said that much better than I, that's pretty much, yeah, what I was getting at, that it's, they connect with you on an individual level and it builds that empathy that they don't have when it's just some,
like something
sort of like far off concept of like, this is something that doesn't affect me. And I don't know any Asian people. So, you know, on a personal level, so like, why should I care sort of thing? And so getting to know people, personally and yeah, we'll build that empathy and connects, I think, the human part of all of us that's there, even in some of the worst people, you know, there's some humanity in there that they can connect to most of the time.
I agree. So my third talking point is that the model minority myth erases the long and oftentimes forgotten history of Asian American oppression in this country and its effects that are still present today. So in a New York Times report, it said that despite having the highest median income of any racial group, Asian Americans also have the largest income gap of any racial group. And in New York City, Asians experience the highest poverty rate of any immigrant group. And this might be from a few years ago, so I don't know exactly how accurate it is. So I would fact check that to be sure. But it's not totally surprising because I've done research about, you know, again, Asian immigrants dating back to the 1800s when they first came to the West Coast to work on the railroads. So I think a lot of us have, you know, heard about this. And these men were treated, you know, kind of similarly to a lot of like, you know, Latinos who come here for a better life to, you know, to do labor and, you know, make a living for their families back at home or bring their families here for a better life. I think they're just seen as, you know, people who are here stealing jobs from the working class white man. So they're very much demonized and, you know, just viewed completely as not only othered, but like just this dangerous group of people. And so that was a very real, you know, kind of reality for the men that came here, dating back to the 1800s. And this has led to a kind of generational oppression, similar to the generational oppression that Black people have experienced. And as we know, it's really hard to rise above that. So something that came as a shock to me when I first learned about it is that a lot of Chinatowns are actually slums with very poor living conditions, poor working conditions. I wrote an article on my website, which is just belindakai.com. I usually repost articles I write for other like news outlets, but this one was one that I just wrote on my blog. But I interviewed this professor at the University of San Francisco who teaches U.S.-China relations. I think they're like a history professor, Dr. Aldous Cruz. And he said, the old Chinatown with 3 to 4 generations is the poorest section of the San Francisco area. They're crowded. They have very little living space. Many residents are very elderly. They have medical problems and don't have good access to medical care. And many don't speak Mandarin or English. So I just thought that was so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That is something I did not know, never heard about, like never would have thought about. That is very interesting.
That is, yeah, I didn't know either, but now that I'm thinking about it, the Chinatown here in Chicago, I just like drove through it once. I haven't really spent much time there, but I remember like looking around being like, this is like not like a super nice part of town. Like I was like surprised. And I guess that's like an example of me as an uninformed white person that like the model minority, like like as much as I hate to admit that, like we all have our, you know, we're all affected by,
we're all human,
like, yeah like, oh, I would have expected like an Asian area to be nice, like a, you know, more like, you know,
like suburban, like middle class type thing.
So that's super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, even for me, like going to Chinatowns, starting from when I was a child, like my parents would go to Chicago and go to Chinatown, or go to New York City and go to Chinatown. And I just remember being enthralled by like, oh, look at all these cute little trinkets, and look at these cool like outdoor markets with all this like yummy food. So I didn't think about the people who are like peddling this stuff. And I think, you know, now that I reflect on it, you have these really desperate, like women and men who are just like kind of in your face, like, oh, you know, buy this umbrella, like, you know, you need this umbrella, it's gonna rain, like, and they'll kind of not leave you alone. And I remember thinking like, oh, that's kind of like annoying, even as a Chinese person. But now it's like they were desperate. These people needed to sell whatever products, you know, they were peddling to have their meal for that day.
Yeah.
So now it just really changed my perspective on Chinatowns. And yeah, it's just, I just definitely don't think that's common knowledge. Because again, as someone who is Chinese American and has been to like a ton of Chinatowns, I never really thought about that myself.
Yeah, it's not common knowledge at all. I'm, you know, if any talk of Chinatowns, it's like, oh, this is fun. Like, let's go look at the little shops. They have so many cute little things they're selling. Let's go get some Chinese food. Let's, you know, it's like a touristy thing. And yeah, people don't think about the actual people that are running the Chinese restaurants and that are running the shops. And, you know, these are real people with real lives that are affected by this issue. So
Right. So there's this great article that's now a few years old. I think it's from 2015, but it's called Two Asian Americas, and it's on The New Yorker. And when I read it, I was just blown away. And that's what inspired me to write my article on my website. It talks really in depth about what we just talked about, which is this whole forgotten kind of time capsule of all of this oppression towards Asians and how that's still alive and well today. But for some weird reason, maybe the way that Asians are portrayed in the media, or just, you know, the Asians that maybe we come into contact with more as more privileged people, you know, myself included, you know, we think of Asians as like, oh, they're doctors, they're engineers, they're scientists, they're rich, they have great family lives. And we forget about these people who are living in what are essentially ghettos and slums and can't speak English and don't have access to medical care. And that's where that kind of like, you know, wage discrepancy comes in.
Yeah. And you had also said, you know, it's most of them don't even speak Mandarin, which is something I think often we forget about, that there are many different languages and dialects, even just in China alone, let alone you know, the rest of Asia. And so Mandarin's just one of them, and not everyone who is Chinese speaks Mandarin. So that can be difficult as far as like just lumping people together, like, oh, you know, nobody, if you don't have the same language, you don't have the same culture, it's very diverse, different beliefs, and just something to be aware of, like taking that into consideration, not assuming.
Yeah, totally. Like, again, Asian Americans are treated as a monolith you know, like, oh, they're all Chinese and speak Chinese, and by Chinese mm-hmm. they mean Mandarin. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. And as someone who is in that majority, because when it comes to Asia, like, you know, the biggest population are like Chinese people who do speak Mandarin, I feel kind of privileged in some ways, even to come from that kind of background, when there are so many other, you know, smaller Asian countries that go under the radar, or like were colonized by China and by Japan. And, or even, you know, like you said, in China, you know, people that have different dialects or speak Cantonese. It's just, it's very nuanced, and a lot of that goes under the radar because it's just like, oh, look, there's a China man, you know, that kind of like just ignorance.
Yeah. I also want to ask slash point out, like, we're mostly talking about East Asia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's South Asians, Indian people, Pakistani people, that I would, and I don't know a ton about this, so I'm just curious what your thoughts are, Belinda, that I would assume face some similar, because they don't look, you know, like they don't, they have like different skin tone, you know, like, it's, they're perceived differently than East Asians, South Asians are. So I would assume they have some similar, face some similar, things.
Oh, totally.
If they have their own set of challenges.
Yeah, totally. If not more so, because I think that there is a lot of erasure when it comes to South Asians or Southeast Asians. And throughout this conversation, since I'm speaking kind of from my own experience as a Chinese American, yes, I was talking mostly about East Asians, and South Asians are just as much Asian as I am. And I definitely think that there's, you know, discrimination in a very similar way, because, you know, there's a lot of colorism in Asia, unfortunately, and also in the US. And I think I read that people who are, you know, like darker skinned, like South Asians, they're sometimes perceived to be like Muslim. And with all the Islamophobia happening, you know, I read that like a lot of Sikh right. people, you know, like Indian Americans have been like attacked for the color of their skin, you know, which is something that I, as a lighter skinned Asian person, haven't experienced as much. So I definitely think that, Emily, you bring up a really important point, and that even as someone who is interested in Asians in America, I find myself not, you know, paying as much attention to South Asians and Southeast Asians. So that's a really important thing to like be mindful of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that kind of goes along with just sort of, unfortunately, you know, us lumping people into a category. When you say Asian American, the first thing I think of is East Asian. But then, of course, then I'm like, okay, wait, no, Asia, there's so many more countries there. But yeah, it's sort of like just lumping people together, like when you think Latinx, you just, you know, people tend are like, oh, Mexican, like everyone is from Mexico, mm-hmm. even though mm-hmm. like that's Central America, and then you have South America, which has so many different countries. And we had kind of talked about this the other night, Emily, like saying like African American or mm-hmm. you know, Black is not always inclusive of people with darker skin tone, because they may not be Black or African American.
Right. I yeah.
Mean, yeah. Sorry. Oh,
but
no.
African American is, or Black is mostly used to as like a synonym for African American, but then you have like Haitian people, Jamaican mm-hmm. people, who often often very much like African American people.
Right. Yeah. And like people from Dominican Republic, like, so yeah, it's just one of those things. Like we have these, labels, these general labels that we sort of put over stuff to make it easier, but it's not, it's still not inclusive, or specific enough to cover all of the different, you know, cultures, and like you said, the way people are treated differently based on where in Asia they're from, colorism, things like that. So yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up and we kind of clarified that.
Totally. I know we don't have too much time left, so I kind of wanted to just like wrap this up with more of like a mental health angle.
Oh my God, I was just about to go.
go ahead, Emily.
No, I was, well, I mean, my specific question was just going to be like how you've gone, if you feel comfortable sharing how you've gone about like healing the trauma that came from this and, you know, caring for your mental health as a result of what you've experienced, but whatever direction you want to go in, go for it.
No, that's a great question. I would say that reading intersectional feminist theorists has really helped me because, you know, they're not always Asian. I did recently read a book by Kathy Park Hong that is a memoir, like essay style memoir, that does talk about her experience as a Korean American. And I related to it so, so much. But, you know, I really like Audre Lorde. I like bell hooks, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I'm probably butchering her name. But, you know, a lot of like Black feminist theorists, and just reading about how they, you know, experienced so many struggles and then became empowered and kind of radicalized through it made me feel the same way. Like it made me feel very empowered to embrace my identity and to be proud of my identity. And I would say that's a huge thing. I would say just surrounding myself with people who are tolerant and allies and are accepting has been huge. And I think I'm pretty privileged to have found those people and also to be now in Los Angeles where there are just so many more people of color everywhere that like in any given, you know, workplace or store, I look around and I am not in the minority. I mean, I might not be, I mean, it may not be like, you know, there are a ton of like Asians, but it's like 50-50 white people and people of color, or maybe more people of color. So just being around that really has been such a nice change because, you know, I go back to like Westchester, Ohio, where my family's from, and sometimes go out and look around and I'm like the only, you know, non-white person there. And, you know, it just makes you kind of more self-conscious and self-aware. And maybe, you know, if you're being treated differently, you're like, oh, is it because they're like noticing my race? Are they being racist? So just, you know, surrounding myself with people who make me feel worthy and accepted and loved. I'm part of a group of empowered like Asian women and non-binary people. So, you know, having this group of other Asians who really get it because they, you know, have had a lot of the same struggles, they come from a very similar background, we can kind of air our grievances and kind of support each other. That's been like immensely supportive. So just finding community, finding the right people, you know, educating myself definitely helps, but you know, it's still a struggle. I just think that white supremacy is so seeped into everything in our culture that like, I think I've come a really long way, but there are still times when I feel self-conscious, like, oh, well, you know, I wish I looked more European or something, which, you know, I feel ashamed almost when I feel that way. But then I'm like, wait a second, everything I see in the media, I mean, it's changing, but for the most part, growing up and like you know, just
yeah, all your influences, you know, that's how you were sort of
programmed.
And that kind of sets this like you have that automatic thought, which we can't control our automatic thoughts. Mm-hmm. It pops into your head. I don't know if this is how it is for you, but I would imagine, you can correct me if I'm wrong. It's like, oh, I wish I looked more European. No, don't think like that. I love myself the way I am. And then you like feel like bad and guilty for having the thought. And then you have to be like, no, it's okay to have that thought. Like, that's how I've been socialized to think. And you have this like loop in your mind that's like, you, like trying to fight against your automatic thoughts. Is that, can you relate to that?
Yeah, for sure. I think I find myself feeling ashamed, like, oh, wow, I have so much internalized racism. I must really hate myself. But then, yeah, I take a step back and I think, well, I'm conditioned to feel this way. It's just something that unfortunately our culture is, you know, it's how it's affecting. I try to be more forgiving and have more self-compassion in those moments and realize that I still have so much to unlearn and so much to learn at the same time. And yeah, I think we should all realize that we're going to have these feelings and thoughts, but we shouldn't judge ourselves. We should examine, why do we have these thoughts? Where are they coming from? Mm-hmm. And how can we, you know, better ourselves in a way where we feel empowered?
It's so important. Yeah,
absolutely. And that's definitely something that we, you know, teach when we're doing like CBT and therapy, of like, where's the source of these thoughts? Who told you these things? Yeah, because you weren't born, you know, feeling this way about yourself. Somebody told you this over and over again, and you started to believe it. And so, yeah, questioning the source and realizing that, like Emily said, the first thought that pops in your head is what you're conditioned and socialized for. And then how you correct that and respond to that is really who you are. And that shows all of the work that you've done. And you had said two things you had said that I think are wonderful and good for anyone, whether it's unlearning and healing from racial trauma or just any trauma in your life, is finding a community. That's a really, really big one, a supportive community, people that accept you, people that encourage you, people that give you space to heal. And then the compassion with yourself during that healing, and that it's not, you know, linear. It's not a quick or easy thing to do. It's obviously, it's painful. And sometimes you question yourself when you're doing it. And so I just, that's really wonderful, because those are two big things I've seen working with anyone who has trauma, that that self-compassion and the finding a community goes a long way in helping people heal from that.
That's really great to hear, Belinda, that you've that you know, you found that community. And you know, I've known you for a long time, and I definitely have I've seen you like put a lot of work into your mental health. Mm-hmm. That's really great. You know, I want to also point out that you know, mental health professionals, like Stephanie and I are both mental health professionals, and neither of us know a lot about this topic, you know, and that's kind of a problem. And how you know, we've talked about this with other topics, but in general, cultural competency of professionals is like, this is clearly affects an Asian person's mental health, yet so many mental health professionals are not knowledgeable about it or really trained about how to talk about it. And that kind of like societal, really silly unspoken rule of like, you're supposed to like pretend you don't notice race or whatever. It kind of creates this, like, you might have an Asian client and like not even talk about the fact that they're Asian, and that just is doing them a disservice, because clearly they're them going through life as an Asian person in America has an impact on their mental health, and making sure that we have mental health professionals leave space, you know, if they want to talk about it, if they want to talk about something, you know, that's not something they want to work through in therapy, that's their choice. But making sure that we feel comfortable treating a client with these experiences is
important. Right.
Totally. You're fine. Oh, I was just going to say, I totally agree. And while I actually haven't personally had an Asian American therapist, I think in the future I would like to have one, because I think he or she would understand me better. Mm-hmm. So I do think it's important that mental health care professionals are just more aware of these racial dynamics. And I just kind of wanted to say overall that Asians, I think less than any other group of people, are likely to seek help. Like Asians, for some reason, I think also because of the model minority myth, have a hard time admitting, okay, I have mental illness, or I'm like, you know, there's too much pressure, I can't handle it, I need help. So they don't go seek out mental health services. And that's just adding to the problem. It's stigmatized. I mean, it's stigmatized still, I think, overall, sadly, although it's changing with the younger generations. But I think with Asians, especially like in my parents' generation, it was very much like, oh, like, what are you talking about? Mental health issues? That's not real. Like, just get over it. Just like deal with it. Just like work harder. And I just think that's extremely damaging and invalidating to someone who is struggling. So my message to anyone who's Asian, or just, you know, obviously anyone in general, is if you need help, like, please get it, because I think it shows so much strength, and it's not weakness at all.
So much strength. Yeah. And you mentioned, we didn't elaborate on this, but when you were talking, you mentioned earlier, access to healthcare, including mental health care, is a piece of this, that you know, that there's are barrier systemic barriers that make it harder for Asian Americans or oppressed groups in general to access mental health care. Plus the shortage of Asian therapists. You know, there is, I've heard minority population saying that, like, there's like always like a little piece of what they experience that, like, if the therapist is white, that they like aren't fully sure the therapist is like getting, and, you know, so yeah, I mean, it would be really beneficial just to improve kind of overall the treatment of mental health for Asian Americans. So
totally. Yeah. And all ethnic minorities.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what I was going to say is, you know, as white clinicians, we not only do we need to be competent and try to always strive to be culturally competent and sensitive and aware, but we also have to do our own work in unlearning a lot of this white supremacy, and also have to do our own work if we're working with a client and, you know, they start telling us about things that that they've experienced, to not take that personally, you know, to not let our white fragility get in the way, and to just be open to what they're saying, and listening to their experiences, not letting it, you know, personally offend us, because it has nothing to do with us. And sometimes,
absolutely,
yeah, white clinicians are afraid of that because they don't know what to do or what to say, and then they get offended. And look, it doesn't matter. It's not about you. It's about the client. So yeah, but Belinda, thank you so much for coming on. And
oh, you're so welcome. I had a great time.
like, I really enjoyed this. This
episode. I learned so much that I did not
Me
know.
Me too. Oh, I'm so glad. So happy to hear that.
Yeah. So how can people, if they want to like contact you or, you know, read your articles or just sort of access your online presence, how can they do that?
So I have a website and it's just BelindaKai.com. And Belinda Kai is my full name. So I'll spell that out really fast. It's B as in boy, E-L-I-N-D-A, Kai with a C as in cat, C-A-I, BelindaKai.com. And on there I have my email address. So if you want to email me, you can do that. And then also I'm on my Instagram a lot. And my Instagram is underscore blender, like the kitchenware, B-L-E-N-D-E-R.
I totally didn't know you had a website. I'm going to.
Oh, yeah. My articles are on there. And also just, you know, my email address, if you want to contact me.
And we can also post that on our Instagram as well. And, and tag you in that stuff as well. So that if people just want to go to, or if they're on our Instagram, they can easily get to your information and find your website as well. So
yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Thank you too so much. I really love this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you. We really appreciate you being open. All right. Well, that's our show. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with friends and family.
And don't forget to follow the show's Instagram for updates on new episodes at Just Mental Health Podcast with an underscore under or after each word.
A period.
Oh, a period. Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. I forgot we changed it. It's Just Mental Health Podcast with a period after each word. We record a new episode every week. This is Stephanie.
And Emily.
And Melinda as the guest for this episode.
Signing off. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.